You're listening to the Tilehurst End Podcast by Reading fans for Reading fans.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Tilehurst End Podcast Decade in Review series as we look back at all the goings on from Reading FC from the last 10 years. My name is Ollie Allen, and looking back with me on the years 2013 to 2017 in this episode is editor of the Tilehurst End, Simeon Pickup. Sim, how's it going?
I'm very good, thanks, especially after a lovely win last night.
Indeed, we are recording this the morning after the Boxing Day 1-0 win over Queen's Park Rangers. And I've tweeted a stat last night that every single time Reading have won on Boxing Day in the last decade, we've gone on to get to the playoffs or indeed win the championship. So that bodes well. Of course, we will talk about one of those seasons getting to the playoffs in this episode, 2016-17, of course. But before that, we've got three seasons of sort of middling to bad in the championship. And I think this will probably be quite not many good things to talk about in this episode, Sim.
No, not at all. I think it's kind of the basically the start of the decline for Reading. Really didn't hit the lows that we really have in the last couple of seasons, but definitely set us on the way to that.
Yeah, it's not going to be quite as bad as the 2017 to present episode, which I am not looking forward to recording in the next couple of hours. But I ended the last episode with Johnny as Brian McDermott was sacked for the first time as Reading found themselves struggling in the Premier League in 2012-13. Nigel Atkins, of course, came in to replace him, but in reality, it was always going to be quite a difficult task for him to keep Reading in the top flight. It was more perhaps, you know, sort of about preparing for life back in the Championship. And that is where we'll start, of course, in the summer of 2013, following that Premier League relegation. Plenty of change on the player front that summer, the likes of Simon Church, Ian Hart, Noel Hunt, Jay Tabb, Jimmy Kebbe, Adrian Mariap. I think they all left the club, and in came Danny Williams, Wayne Bridge for his last hurrah, and of course the infamous Royston Drenthe. It was quite clear that, you know, someone like Drenthe was very much an Anton Zingarabit signing, and that is sadly a name we will be discussing plenty today. But Sim, what were your expectations, you know, ahead of life back in the Championship under Nigel Atkins?
I was really optimistic back at the time, actually. It seemed like we were really going to try and go big on our return to the Championship. We spent pretty big on people like Williams, Bridge and Drenthe, as you say. And it looked like with Nigel Atkins at the helm, we had a guy who was who knew how to get out of the Championship and play good football in the process. But looking back at it, of course, a lot more needed to be done. Needed, say, another striker in there and a few other signings being made as well. But back at the time, it did just feel like a really positive time. It really felt like we were going to be competing up at the top of the Championship, at the least. And, well, looking back on it now, it's a very misplaced optimism.
Yeah, it was a very strange season in many ways. I think, obviously, the relegated side, you obviously have these expectations to be trying to challenge near the top of the table. And obviously, we weren't ever really that close to promotion. Obviously, we had that incident on the last day of the season, of course, you know, famous now, that we were in the playoffs going into the final few seconds, and then a Brighton goal at and Nottingham Forest knocked us out. And we had that very ill-judged pitch invasion against Burnley, and then we had to all trudgingly, you know, get back to our seats. And it wasn't to be a finished seventh. But for me, that season, I don't really remember any particularly memorable games apart from, you know, sort of in January when we had those fantastic wins, like the 7-1 over Bolton, which obviously is our biggest win of the decade, and the 5-1 over Blackpool as well, with Lafondre getting hat-tricks in both of those games. But for me, Sim, other than those two games, and I think Alex Pearce's step-overs against Doncaster as well sort of stand out for me from that season, but other than, you know, a few sort of small moments, there aren't that many games that I really remember. And it's more the fact that it's the off-the-field problems that we sort of began to see in that season, taking a bit of a decline.
Yeah, for me, the season, it started out quite well, actually. I thought we were playing some good football and we had a pretty good start. I think even up going up until that away win at Forest, where I think Jordan Abita got his first goal, we looked pretty good in those early stages, and some of the new signings are doing pretty well. I thought Drenthe had a few good games back then. Actually, Wayne Bridge was looking pretty good at left back, but then we picked up some really big injuries around that time as well. Sean Morrison got injured, Wayne Bridge as well. And that seemed to coincide with our slip in form with Wayne Bridge going out the side. We had, I think, Gunter tried out at left back, Cummings at left back, Stephen Kelly at left back as well. And we really struggled for a couple of months. And it wasn't really until the new year when Obita came in at left back for the first time. And we really settled on a new system, a new formation. Don't think we changed the team for about 11 straight games, but we really started to push back up the table in the new year. Lafondre scored a couple of hat-tricks, as you say. As the season went on, it felt like we were just trying to battle into the top six, but didn't quite have that extra element to do it. We did have, obviously, the goals of Lafondre and some other good players in the side, but it was still a pretty narrow squad at that point. We didn't have much strength in depth, obviously couldn't afford to bring in any other players in January to bolster the squad. And I think the fact that we got to the very end of the season with a real shot of getting into the top six was a good achievement, especially given all the problems off the pitch at the time, which I'm sure must have really distracted the players and the manager. And it's credit to them that they actually managed to get into the final day with a shot of promotion.
Yeah, we will, you know, sort of have to discuss that. I mean, Anton Zingaric wasn't at a Reading game after August 2013, and it became, you know, clear very quickly that he sort of ran out of money, or ran out of his dad's money, shall we say. It became very clear that he wasn't interested in the football club anymore, wanted to sell the club, but he didn't really want to try and do that himself. It was left to Sir John Medeski to try and sell the club. You know, you look at the sort of the likes of Billy Sharp and Chris Baird, they came in on short-term deals early on in that season, but we didn't have the funds to sign them permanently, which is a real shame, because I think, you know, you look at the impact that Sharp and Baird had on that side, and even though they weren't here for a very long time, it's clear that, you know, they certainly added the quality, perhaps. And, you know, you look at Billy Sharp now, he's had a fantastic last few years with Sheffield United, and how, you know, how well we could have done with those goals. It was officially announced that Zingaric had left the board at the beginning of June, but again, you know, still not confirmed a buyer. And you know, John Medeski, who'd lost virtually all of his fortune at that point, was desperate to find a buyer. And you know, that summer, the summer 2014, we were forced to sell Adam Lafondre to Cardiff. I think it was about three and a half million. That, you know, at the time was sort of reported to keep Reading in business. And you know, we spoke to Lafondre as well for an interview on a Tile FM last year, and he sort of said that, you know, it was either him or Alex McCarthy that was just sort of said that you're going to have to leave because the club needs the money. And of course, McCarthy as well departed that summer along with Sean Morrison. But you know, how close, you know, do you think did we come to that administration, Mark?
I don't think you can ever really tell properly looking from the outside in, but it did feel like a really panicky summer, didn't it?
Yeah.
So many owners kind of coming in, potential owners rather, coming in and out, and potentially looking to buy the club, not quite getting there. I remember Mohit Burman, sports fan from India, Teddy Sagi from Israel.
Teddy Sagi stands out for me.
Exactly. People from all over the world, really, interested in buying Reading. I think there were reports at the time that it was in the involvement of Chris Samuelson and some kind of financial commitment to keeping him involved in the club that was holding up people from coming in and negotiating to buy the club. And I think if that hadn't been there, we might very well have got an owner, a new owner, a lot sooner, even as early as December the previous season when the Imanis were looking at the club. But to be fair, it's very much to the Ties' credit that they did manage to get that deal over the line in the end. I know it was originally supposed to be Samrit Bundit Kitsada, I think it was, and then his shares in that deal went to Narin Narutananon later on. But it was just a massive slog that summer, and just I think looking back at that kind of summer, it's the kind of one where you kind of take it for granted that Reading did manage to stay in business, did manage to get owners that actually did quite well for the club. They put in a decent amount of money, obviously. Didn't take it up to the next level as you would have hoped they would, but they still did us pretty well in the long run.
I think that's the point, really. I think we don't perhaps look back on the Ties tenure and as owners with an awful lot of fondness, considering, you know, sort of how it ended and you know, the fact that they didn't really, you know, invest, you know, the money that the Reading needed to get to the next level, and sort of the whole, you know, it's still ongoing about were they really in it sort of for the land or whatnot. And, you know, you look at the troubles that Tiger's having at Oxford at the moment. But really, I think it can't be understated how important it was that they came in that summer to effectively save the football club, because, you know, Sir John couldn't keep it going for an awful lot longer. Sinjarovic had buggered off somewhere. You know, I've got no idea where he is now, but as I say, it just didn't care about the club, you know, whatsoever. So I don't think it can be understated how important it was that the ties came in, but it did lead, as you say, to sort of a bit of a strange summer. You know, we mentioned those sales of McCarthy, Lafondra and Morrison, but it also meant that we didn't really sign anybody until sort of mid-August. Simon Cox came in, he returned to the club, Anton Fernand, Oliver Norwood came in as well, Jimmy Mackey, and Glenn Murray on loan. But it did sort of mean that we sort of started that season, 2014-15, under Nigel Adkins, you know, with quite a few young players from the side. You know, you look at the likes of Aaron Cole came in and played, you know, pretty well. Craig Tanner as well, I think, were a couple of names. But how did you look at that season, you know, sort of begin with Sim, under Nigel Adkins?
We actually started off that season quite well, I thought. There was a really good win over Fulham where I think Glenn Murray might have scored twice on his debut, entertaining 3-3 with Wolves at home as well. And at that point, it looked like things were going quite well in the first couple of weeks, at least. Cox and Murray were linking up pretty well. But as the season started to drag on, as we got some really bad injuries in the first couple of months of the season, I think we had about maybe roughly a dozen players out at that point. It was very clear that a difficult summer for us was really taking its toll. That we didn't have the depth in the squad, we didn't have enough quality throughout the team to properly keep going, basically. And although Adkins got a lot of flack at that point for not particularly good tactics and perhaps being a bit too optimistic when he should have been a bit more realistic, he had a really difficult job at that point. It was just kind of just trying to basically keep the club going, keep the team going in really difficult circumstances. And yeah, it's an annoying start to the season, but there you go.
I said, you know, throughout that whole period that I wouldn't have blamed Adkins at all if he just walked away from the football club, because I don't think, you know, we've talked about the behind the scenes issues and the effect that would have had on Adkins, you know, the frustration of not being able to sign anybody until mid-August, we say, you know, losing key players in Morrison, Lafondra and McCarthy, and his hands were almost, you know, tied in that sense, and, you know, forced to sort of use the players that were in the academy. Obviously, they had done very well. They'd won the Premier League Cup and they got to the semi-finals of the FA Youth Cup. But, you know, you don't really want to be sort of basing your squad around those players. And as I said, I think to an extent, Adkins was, his hands were tied, and you have to respect him for that and the way that he dealt with those off the field issues. And you say a very, very positive guy throughout all of that as well. He was ultimately sacked in December 2014. Following the 6-1 defeat to Birmingham City away from home, that left Reading 16th in the table. What was your general feeling towards that sacking, Sim? As we mentioned, you know, a very positive guy, dealt very well behind the scenes with those issues, but Reading were sort of beginning to stagnate a little bit in the Championship.
Yeah, Reading was slipping at that point. The defence was just not tight enough, basically. He needed someone to just come in, freshen things up, reorganise, remotivate the team. And I think at least at the time, Steve Clarke was the right kind of appointment, someone to just give the squad a bit of a kick, basically. And Adkins had done a good job in the circumstances, or could have done a lot worse job in the circumstances. But at some points, you just need someone to come in and just freshen things up. And it was the right time for a change at that point.
And Steve Clarke came in just 24 hours after Nigel Adkins was sacked. Perhaps a bit of a rushed appointment from Reading, who knows? But you know, Steve Clarke, you know, would go on to admit that, you know, Anki was on holiday in the Caribbean just 24 hours before, you know, his first press conference at the Malacey Stadium. You know, admitted that he didn't do his due diligence, I think were his words, on coming into the club, and ultimately it didn't, you know, work out for him. You know, we'll talk about his first summer in charge just a minute. But of course, the second half of that season, 14-15, Reading went on that fantastic FA Cup run. We talked about the FA Cup run with Johnny in 10-11 and 09-10 in the last episode. But this, of course, topped both of those. Reading got all the way to the semi-finals of the FA Cup, beating Huddersfield via replay in the third round. Then I think that was it. After that was the was Derby game, was that away, or was there one more game before that possibly? I think
Cardiff then Derby.
Cardiff away, that's the one. Harrops and Carter, I think, scored. I think Oliver Norwood scored a fantastic free kick at Cardiff away, fantastic away day. Then it was that Derby game where Yakubu, of all people, of course, he came in that January. I mean, obviously, you know, I think that goal probably paid his entire wages for his time here. That goal away to Derby, and of course, then that quarter final against Bradford, the dire 0-0 draw away from home, but in that 3-0 win at the Manstad, I think one of probably my favourite games from the last decade was that 3-0 win, because it's quite odd that in a game of that high pressure you can sort of enjoy it, because Reading were 2-0 up after 10-15 minutes, and it's quite rare that you can enjoy a game of sort of that magnitude. You're usually sort of quite filled with nerves and quite tense, but it did almost feel like after Reading got that two-goal early lead that we were going to go on and get to that semi-final.
That game felt really special as well. Sorry to interrupt, but it did feel really special. It was the first time that we managed to get to an FA Cup semi-final, and obviously we've had some really good other nights at the Medeski, getting to playoff finals and FA Cup shocks and stuff like that. But to have such a special night like that, to get to a semi-final for the first time since 1927, really was it felt unique, and I don't think you can really kind of overlook nights like that. And unless we get to, say, an FA Cup final, I don't think we're going to have anything quite as special as that again, really.
No, I completely agree. And I think even if we did get to an FA Cup final, the fact that that game was in front of our own fans, and as I say, that the atmosphere at the Manstad that night, you know, it was, you know, we're talking about a period here where Reading didn't have an awful lot to cheer about on the pitch, and it was the atmosphere was slowly declining at the Manstad, and that night was a reminder of just how good the atmosphere can be, you know, when Reading fans get up for it. And as I say, you know, when Jamie Mackey scored that third goal in front of what is now the Eamon Dolan stand, and you know, I'm never a massive advocate of pitch invasions. And I think, and you know, we talked about that fateful one against Burnley on the final day of 13-14, but as you say, that felt like a really, really special night and a really significant one in Reading's history. And you say it's only happened twice that we've got to an FA Cup semi-final. Who knows when it's going to happen again? So, of course, yeah, no, it was that game at Wembley. As I say, we've not had an awful lot of luck at Wembley at all this decade. Of course, Gareth McCleary equalised in normal time after Arsenal had gone 1-0 up, but then that horrible Adam Federici error as he let that ball slip through his fingers. And I really felt for Federici that day, because he'd had a fantastic season. I think he won Player of the Season that year as well. And if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have got to the semi-final, and we certainly wouldn't have got to extra time in that game against Arsenal without him. So it was almost the worst person that it could have happened to him, that era.
Yeah, absolutely. You can see just how distraught he was after the game, which you hate to see when someone probably feels quite directly linked to Reading losing. And it was it was horrible to see. But as you say, great credit to him for keeping us in the game before that. And we should remember that just as much for him keeping us in the game and getting us as far as he did, even if it did obviously end in really sad circumstances.
Yeah, and indeed, of course, that the FA Cup run was really a silver lining, really, in what was really quite a poor run of league games under Steve Clarke in the second half of 2014-15. And certainly without the FA Cup run, I don't think we'd look back on Steve Clarke's tenure very well at all. I think just 3 wins in 17 games from mid-February onwards under Steve Clarke in the league, of course, including that 3-0 away win to Derby on the final day, which did seem to give Reading a little bit of hope going into the next campaign. But we'll look at now the summer of 2015, which seemed to be quite a significant one for me, I think, in Reading's recent history and sort of the change that happened there. Again, we talked about the previous summer and the summer before that about the players going out, but this felt really like a change in the guard, really, because that summer, Adam Federici, Alex Pearce, Jem Carrachan, all departed, and of course, all key members of the promotion-winning side in 11-12 and all stalwarts of the club, you know, Pearce and Carrachan, of course, academy graduates. Federici had, you know, been here, you know, since 2005, I think it was, and obviously it felt like a real change and sort of significant, you know, perhaps even the end of the Reading way. I think, you know, me and Johnny spoke a little bit about that in the last episode when Brian McDermott departed, it was clear that Zingarić was now calling the shots. But in terms of player departures and players coming in, you know, we saw again that summer six loanees come in, the likes of Matej Vidra, Ola John, Lucas Pearson. It was almost clear that Reading were going in a very different direction sim that summer.
Yeah, that felt like the really big decisive summer in our post-Premier League era, I guess. As you say, a lot of really important players went out of the club. Players who really felt like the heartbeat of the club, really. You knew that people like Federici, Karachan and Pierce were basically the fans on the pitch. They were very much Reading men through and through. And when players like that leave, you have to be really careful about how you replace them. Obviously, we brought in some really experienced people like Quinn and McShane and Al Habsi as well, who I don't think should be underestimated or understated in that summer. But on the whole, it was very much a summer of the ties really showing their intent for the first time, because I think they come in a little bit too late the previous year to properly have an influence then. But they could really show their intent that summer, spending a lot of money on the loanee signings. Also, I think they sent the team on a tour of Thailand. We played a game out in Bangkok at that point, things like that. And it really felt like the start of the Thai era, the proper start of the Thai era, in terms of them having their influence on the club. But the more I look back on it, that summer feels like the summer when Reading kind of lost their old way and started going down the route of short-term, expensive, quite unwise signings, not really keeping in touch with the fans and how we wanted the team to be, to represent us on the pitch, basically. It was a real big kind of sliding doors moment, essentially, for the club.
And of course, Lady Sassima wrote that fantastic song that I still stand by. Is an absolute banger, really.
If it wasn't a football song, I think it'd actually rank quite highly. If it was entered for Eurovision, perhaps it would actually do pretty well. But as a football song, it obviously wasn't great. And I remember the Leeds game. I think it was our first home match of the season, and she gave a speech on the pitch. I think it was, and the Leeds fans all just drowned it out back when we had about 4,000 Leeds fans at one end of the stadium, all drowning her out, and they had to release the transcript of the speech after the match so that people could actually work out what she said.
Yeah, I mean, I think Leeds fans were probably the worst set of opposition fans you could have perhaps hoped for her to do that speech. And yeah, it was quite clear a change of the guard. But, you know, really, you know, we started that season, you know, in very, very good form. You know, we lost two of the first 12 games. I think we were as high as second at one point. Of course, had that fantastic 5-1 win over Ipswich in September, where Orlando Sarr scored a hat-trick. I think Nick Blackman got two. And I think Vidra made his debut that day as well. Norwood scored a fantastic goal from range. And I think we tweeted from the Tyler Send account that Reading were back. You know, this was Reading ready to make a charge on the championship title once again. And, you know, we went on, I think we got four wins in a row against Bristol City, Burnley, Middlesbrough, Charlton. I think the likes of Burnley and Barrett at the time were right up there. And it felt like it was really, really entertaining football sim. And I think, you know, we've spoken about it a little bit sort of in private, but was that some of the best football that we played this decade under Steve Clarke in those first few months of 15-16?
Yeah, I thought it was. I thought it was a really balanced side. We had some really experienced players in there, people like McShane and Al Habsi and Williams really giving us some steel in that team. But we also had a bit of flair, Blackman really turning it on, Vidra as well, even Pearson a little bit as well. I know we kind of look back on his time with not a great deal of fondness, but at points he was actually playing some good football. Good goal in that Fulham 4-2 defeat, for example. But I think that team did just rely a little bit too heavily, perhaps, on people like Shibola and Quinn and Robson Carney, who gave it some balance, basically. And when those three all got injured...
What was a bad idea when you're relying on how Robson Carney would decide?
Exactly, yeah, you should never do that. And I think other managers have found that out to their cost as well, not just Steve Clarke. But when we did lose those players like Quinn and Shibola, the side just lost a lot of balance. And as much as we talk about kind of like the Fulham game, the 4-2 defeat and how much of an impact that had when you don't have players in there like Quinn and Tshabola to fall back on, you are going to have results like that and you are going to struggle to bounce back.
That Fulham game did certainly seem like a turning point. Of course, 2-0 up at one point before going on to lose 4-2. And I remember sitting in the away end at Craven Cottage that day. You know, we were 2-0 up at half time, I think it was. And it was almost a sense of that this can't really get any better. And it certainly didn't, because it was downhill from there, really. And again, you know, you can talk about, you know, turning points, and that game certainly was one. And Fulham again would be sort of in the headlines with us a few weeks later, as Steve Clarke, of course, went to speak to Fulham about the vacant managerial position there, didn't take it, came back to Reading, you know. And again, is that almost a point of no return, Sim? Because even though he has, in a sense, shown loyalty to Reading by turning down that Fulham job, I think by going to speak to him in the first place, whilst he's within, you know, every right to do that and to explore, you know, his career possibilities, and it was very clear that throughout his time at Reading that Reading was very much a stepping stone, I think, for Steve Clarke, and that he was always aiming to try and get on to bigger and better things. And you could, I suppose, ultimately say that he's got that in achieving the Scotland job now via Kilmarnock. But it was clear that he was a very ambitious manager, obviously, being at Chelsea, being an assistant before that. But is that almost a point of no return, certainly with the fan base, that when you go to another club, and especially a club that are lower down than you in the table, it's almost a point of no return with the fan base?
Yeah, absolutely. And the managerial position is about having the respect and having faith from other people around the club, everyone else around the club, really. You need the players to trust you, you need the fans to believe in you, you need the board to really have the faith that you're the right man for the job. And if you do make it very clear that you're happy to go off and talk to a team who I think were lower than us in the table at the time. Yeah. It's one thing if it were a Premier League side. I think if Fulham were a Premier League side and he'd gone off and talked to them and said, actually, no, I'm all right, I'm going to stay at Reading, he might have even been in an even stronger position turning down another club. It's more the fact that he was so open to going to any other club, seemingly, that really... that just really felt like a betrayal, basically. And when you're already going through a rough time in the league, the players are going to think, why should we play for this guy? Why should we run that extra yard for him? Why should we put in that extra bit of effort? And in the end, it just added another nail in his coffin, essentially.
I think that's the thing as well. I think that's spot on. The fact that the players, you know, might clearly have felt that Clarke didn't believe in them, that he wasn't happy with the players he had at his disposal, that he felt he could have done better elsewhere. So, in, you know, whether it is Clarke going to speak to Fulham, whether it was the knock of confidence that the defeat at Fulham cost us, whether it was, you know, the absence of Quinn or Tshabola, Reading did then, you know, begin to not massively slide up on the table, but certainly results dropped. Just one win in six after that, and I think that one win was against a side, I think it might have been
Bolton. It was an absolutely dire home win, and Bolton were rock bottom of the table at the time.
Yeah, quite.
It's the kind of win that showed just how much we'd fallen. In a way, it was not the kind of confident, free flowing win that you want to see against a team at the bottom of the table. It was a kind of almost an awkward win, really. I think it was the first game after the news had come out, and Clarke had said before the game, please just focus on the team, support the players and everything. Don't worry about what I've done. Try and ignore that to the fans. Try and move on from it. But if the players are kind of putting in a half-hearted win over statistically the worst side in the division, it doesn't add that much more confidence, really. And when you then follow it up with a couple of really bad defeats, one against Forest, one against QPR as well, that sealed his fate, it didn't do too much.
Yeah, it was that defeat to QPR that ended up costing him his job. You know, quite ironically, it was a 1-0 defeat to QPR on a Thursday night, which, of course, we've just beaten QPR 1-0 on a Thursday night. So that comes around quite nicely. Yeah, I think it was a late Ali Al-Habsi era. Of course, you know, we speak about Al-Habsi so highly now in the saves that he made in the second half of that season and in the following season as well. But, you know, he didn't have the best of start to life at Reading, and made that error. I think Nedim Manura scored And that was indeed the final nail in Steve Clark's coffin. Reading ninth in the table, so not actually that low in the table. I think that's probably one of the highest positions Reading have been in the league table when a manager's been sacked in the last few years. You know, you look at when a manager's been sacked, I think, you know, as you say, I think Atkins was 16th in the table. Jose Gomez, obviously, I think was probably about 18th, 19th when he was sacked early this season. Paul Clement was 21st or whatever. So, you know, not necessarily that low on the table for Steve Clark, but it did seem as though his time at Reading was up. In then came Brian McDermott for his second spell at the club. And to me, Sim, it seemed as though it was almost one last attempt at that Reading, where we spoke about the club very much changing. It seemed as though Nigel Howe was having one last go at sort of influencing the managerial decisions and by bringing in Brian McDermott. And it really divided the fan base, that appointment. McDermott, obviously a hugely popular character from his first spell, one of only two men to get Reading into the Premier League. But it seemed to divide that fan base and almost, was it a sense that never go back?
I think at the start it was less a case of it being divisive, more of the appointment being so incredibly bland, basically. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of positivity to get behind it. There wasn't this sudden boost when he came in, as you often get from new managers. It was just a feeling that we'd almost just taken the cheap option, basically. No disrespect to McDermott, obviously, but because things had ended for him so disappointingly at the end, we were remembering that as much as all the big achievements he'd made earlier on. And when things didn't pick up for him over the rest of the season, there wasn't that kind of that positivity and that same love to keep him going. And as you say, it did get very negative, did it get very bitter in the fan base. That felt like the first real split in the fan base post relegation. Obviously one that we'd get again with Yapstam a couple of seasons afterwards, but it was a really, really bitter time. And besides the FA Cup run, which I think we overlook a little bit because of the semi-final achievement the previous season, apart from that, there wasn't really anything to shout about.
I mean, in the league, of course, we ended up finishing 17th that season. You know, so going from 9th under when Clark was sacked at 17th at the end of the season, and you say that cup run as well, I think was the one main positive from that McDermott time. For me, it sort of culminated in that away game at Middlesbrough. I think we lost 2-1, quite a late goal. Danny Williams and Paul McShane like square up in that game. Post-match, Brian McDermott had a bit of a spat with Tim Deller. It just seemed quite toxic, really, which is a really, really sad word to use when talking about a manager who really brought Reading so much success in his first spell. But yeah, it just felt a little bit toxic. And then that summer, of course, McDermott was sacked. Again, as we say, it sort of divided the fan base's appointment. So there were some fans who were very, very pleased to see that happen. Others who felt he deserved more respect as someone who'd done so well for the club. What was your take on that sacking, Sim? Was it almost a sense that it was an experiment that hadn't really paid off bringing McDermott about, or did you feel that he sort of deserved more time to potentially try and get another promotion for Reading?
When he was there, I did feel that he deserved a little bit more time, but kind of by the end of his time there, it just felt like he wasn't really the right man to take us forward. He didn't. Whatever he was going to do, he'd have a lot of work to take us forwards and to give us basically a fresh start. Obviously, the transfers would need a lot of work, but it didn't really feel like he was that figurehead to really take the club forward and to really inspire the fans and everything. And even just in terms of boosting his own popularity, boosting his own respect at the club and in the fan base would have taken a decent amount of work, and obviously really sad the way it ended for him. And I think in Simon Cox's recent interview with us, he did suggest that McDermott kind of already knew the writing was on the wall even before he was sacked. And yeah, obviously sad that things ended up that way for him, but in the long run, I think it was the right decision.
I think it is important to look back on, you know, Brian McDermott in general is very, very positive, because it perhaps is easy, you know, for a bit of recency bias to look back on his second spell, you know, and not look at him in the best light. But look, you can't you can't say anything bad about a man who's got run into the Premier League. And you know, this, you know, me and Johnny spoke about it in the first episode. The spirit that he fostered in that side in 11-12 was just fantastic. And I don't think you can say a bad word about him despite that second spell. And I think it probably is circumstances almost beyond his control behind the scenes that maybe affected that second spell. But Reading then went in a very different direction that summer in 2016, the appointment of the club's first ever foreign manager. And what a name it was. Jaap Stam, legendary player for the Netherlands, for Manchester United and plenty of other clubs, you know, multiple Champions Leagues and whatnot. First ever foreign manager for Reading. And yeah, it was very clear that Reading were going in a very different direction. Brian Tevreden had come in as technical director or director of football earlier that year, following the departure of Nick Hammond to West Brom. And you know, it was clear that Tevreden had a big impact on the appointment of Jaap Stam. And it was clear that, as I say, the Reading, you know, were going in a very different direction.
Yeah, it felt like an actual really clear direction off the pitch for a change, which is in very stark contrast to other summers we've had. And I know we look back on that summer with a bit of frustration because there were a lot of signings that were duds, basically people like Sandro Visa and Danzel Gravenberch, who were little more than just squad filler, basically. But when I look back on that summer, I look at people like Roy Behrens, Joey van den Berg, Liam Moore, Tyler Blackett, actually decent. We actually got decent returns on them over the course of that season. John Swift as well, of course. Decent returns, and they weren't overly expensive signings. I know we couldn't spend a lot of money that summer, but we still managed to get a decent amount of value out of them. Obviously, it didn't go so well the next season, but at least that campaign, we freshened things up really well, and it actually was really positive and refreshing to see the club have a clear idea of what they wanted to do.
Yeah, you mentioned the likes of van den Berg, Roy Behrens, Liam Moore, John Swift coming in that season. It was very clear that Reading were going towards this possession, you know, style of play that obviously Stam was known for. You know, came through, did his managerial badges at Ajax, and was manager of the Ajax reserve team. And you know, as we say, you know, it led to Reading dominating possession in games, and you know, I think had possibly the highest average possession in the entire Championship this season. And while it was getting results to an extent, I think, you know, you saw many fans, you know, potentially turning away. They found it a bit unentertaining. You know, Reading sort of just passing the ball around the back quite a lot, you know, back to the right, back to the centre, back to the goalkeeper, back out to the fullback, and not moving the ball upfield very, very quickly. And, you know, quite a lot of fans, you know, were quite critical of that. And as I say, not the most entertaining football to watch. But as I say, it did get results, but then at the same time, it led us, you know, to the old battering, you know, 5-0 against Fulham, 7-1 against Norwich. You know, they're very unusual results for a side who end up finishing third. And I think because of those results, we only ended up, I think, with a goal difference of, you know, possibly, you know, something like +1 or +2, really. But what was your take on the playing style, Sim? Because I think, you know, we're sort of, you know, almost seeing the same sort of thing now against, you know, sorry, with Mark Bowen, that we're getting results, but it's not necessarily the most entertaining football to watch. You know, some fans, you know, describing it as a sort of long ball football. And it was almost the same with Stam, that we were getting results, but it wasn't necessarily the best football to watch.
I thought it was the start of a really big disconnect between the team itself and the fans, really. The fans turn up wanting to watch vaguely entertaining football. They want to see a real concerted effort to actually try and score goals and play reasonably entertaining football. And when you do see the team passing it around the back, particularly for a club like Reading, where we're very used to playing much more direct, entertaining football than that, and of course we've been very successful with it under McDermott and Coppell as well, when you see the team suddenly start doing that, it's not just that it's not entertaining, which is obviously a big part of it, but fans didn't really understand why it was happening. It still felt like they were just knocking the ball around for the sake of it. There wasn't really any point of it. And when I don't think the manager or the team is doing a particularly good job of explaining why, when they're not really kind of trying to build that understanding with the fans of what they're trying to achieve, and there's not a great deal of entertainment, it felt like a big disconnect. really. It really felt like the team was on one page and the fans were on a completely opposite one. And despite the results, there was still that kind of coldness, basically.
It was a really, really bizarre season for me because it almost, you know, we finished third that season. Newcastle and Brighton were far and away the best sides in that league, but we were still technically the best of the rest. But it didn't feel like that at all because, as you say, that apathy, there wasn't an awful lot of entertainment. You know, we had the key games, you know, obviously the win against Leeds at home, the win against Sheffield Wednesday away from home. And there were those key moments, but it almost seemed like just one sort of big blur for me that Reading had somehow got the third in the league. And you can say they almost were there on merit, but we talk about, you know, the attacking football. You know, in fact, we did score 68 goals this season, which was, I think, the most in the top six. I mean, I think Fulham might have got a few more, but we still scored more goals than Sheffield Wednesday and Huddersfield, who finished fourth and fifth. But then it was that defence that was just leaking goals non-stop. And again, that's bizarre because they're a team coached by a world-class defender or a former world-class defender who just didn't seem to have any sort of grasp on defensive coaching. But were Reading, well, I say the word lucky because, you know, we talk about expected goals quite a lot. And I think the expected goals model had us down to finish 17th that season, you know, and it's been brought up quite a lot since that season because that season almost is an anomaly, really, in sort of Reading's recent history. You know, we'll talk about the following seasons in the next episode of this decade in review. But before this season, they finished 17th and 19th. They finished 20th in the two seasons following it. And this third place finish is very much an anomaly. And as you say, the stats had us down to finish 17th. We were defying the odds. You know, we were clearly very, very clinical. And I've always, it's probably easy to discuss it now rather than it is at the time. Because I think at the time, you almost get caught up in this bubble that Reading aren't lucky, that, you know, Reading are just clinical, we've done fantastically well to get to the third in the league. What's your take now, Sim, sort of 2.5 years on from that third place finish? Were Reading lucky to finish third?
No, I don't think we were, to be honest. Stats are really good at picking up some things, really good at picking up how many chances you make, how good those chances are with things like XG. But if a team finishes third over the course of an entire season, it isn't lucky. There must be some kind of patterns, must be some things we're doing really well over the course of that season to get us there. And yes, we were capable of defending really abysmally. In certain games, we were not particularly great going forwards. It wasn't particularly entertaining football, but although there are some stats that illustrate all of that quite well, there are other important stats as well. We were consistently good at edging teams by one goal. And over the course of a few games, that can be one thing. But to do it over the course of a season shows that we had a huge amount of team spirit, a huge amount of character to consistently absorb a lot of pressure. Obviously, we had Jan Kermigant consistently scoring goals. We had Ali Al-Habsi pulling off great saves week in, week out. And when you're doing that reliably, week in, week out, typically at home, because I think we only lost twice at home all season, imperious home form, consistently edging teams by one goal, maybe two, shows that we were a really effective side. Not effective in the conventional sense. We weren't really tight consistently at the back. We weren't playing really attractive, expansive football, but we knew how to win games, and the table doesn't lie in that regard.
I do tend to agree with you. I think over the course of 46 games, there's no such... I mean, I think luck probably balanced itself out, and I think Reading were just clinical that season. Everything seemed to click. Jan Kermigant, at 33 years old, had a fantastic season in front of goal. As you mentioned, Al-Habsi made a number of numerous saves, you know, and I'm sure we'll talk about in the next episodes how the absence of those two players in the next season potentially contributed to Reading's downfall and ultimately Yapstam's downfall. But everything did seem to click for Reading that season. We ended up finishing third, as I say, qualifying for the playoffs, where we were drawn against Fulham, or qualified against Fulham because they finished sixth. And even though they had finished sixth and Reading had finished third, it very much felt that Fulham were the bookies' favourites, sort of the media darlings, in a sense, for that game, despite, as I say, them finishing sixth. I mean, they came into it in pretty good form. You know, the likes of Ryan Sessegnon, who was the, you know, teenage sensation at the time, and And Fulham were very much the favourites to get through to the final from that semi-final. It did, of course, finish 1-1 in that first leg. Jordan Mbeeta scoring that fantastic goal to open the score at Craven Cottage. And, you know, we've spoken about, you know, some sort of key games in that promotion-winning season with Johnny in the last episode. You know, the wins away to Southampton and to West Ham. Of course, the away game in the FA Cup a few years before that as well against Cardiff. And Sim, this was very much, again, up there as one of the great away days of the decade.
Yeah, I think what really stands out about it for me is that we've talked previously about how much the team has kind of moved away from the fan base. It kind of felt less like Reading. But you go back to the two games against Fulham in the playoff semi-finals, and it felt like proper, classic, vintage Reading, really going up against a team that's much more fancied. Very much the media darlings, everyone fawning over how good Fulham are going forwards and all of this. Not really giving Reading much of a chance. Everyone writing us off, seemingly. Us going into these two massive games with not fancied or anything like that, and really giving them a bloody nose and really, really playing the occasion fantastically well. A huge amount of spirit, a huge amount of fight. Great organisation and obviously some really good saves from Al Habsi in the second leg to keep us in it. And perhaps if he hadn't made those, we wouldn't have gone to Wembley at all. But you just love nights like that. You love Reading showing passion, not necessarily a lot of quality, particularly say scoring quite a scrappily one penalty in the second leg. But we showed the character, we showed the fight, and it's days like that that really resonate with the fans and will live long in the memory. And that Jordan Mbeeta goal at Craven Cottage was absolutely, it was amazing. I was right behind it in the away end. You know when you're right behind the flight of the ball,
yeah,
and it's, you see it come straight towards you into the net. There's nothing quite as good at it. It's absolutely, it's phenomenal. And the away end erupted when that went in, absolutely exploded with joy. And it's out of all my decade memories from the 2010s, I think that goal for that's those few moments of absolute ecstasy in the away end, everyone jumping around so much you can barely stay in your row because you're falling over the seat in front of you. You're celebrating with people you have you've never met before. You're hugging people, you're kissing people, absolutely jumping around like a madman. It was absolutely fantastic, and it's one of those memories that you just live for as a football fan. And God, it was amazing.
I think the fact that it was Jordan Mbeeta as well, you know, an academy graduate, one of our own, doesn't score an awful lot of goals. Obviously, he's a left back, and just you know, when he hit that, you knew it was going, and it was just fantastic. And again, that second leg for me was just fantastic. You know, one of the great Mad Stab nights of the decade. And as I say, it was made all the more sweeter by the fact that everyone was expecting Fulham to win, even after that first leg where we'd held our own, gone in front. Obviously, Paul McShane got that red card, you know, which is, you know, often forgotten in that first leg. And Reading sort of played the final half an hour or so with 10 men and still held on for that 1-1 draw. And then we come back to the Medeski in the second leg, and there couldn't be a better man, I think, for than Jan Kermigan to score that penalty, because he'd obviously been fantastic that season for us. You know, at 33 years old, you know, you don't expect to be relying on someone of that age, but he really did, you know, drag Reading through that season at times. And as I say, there couldn't be a better man to put that penalty away. And I think especially after his sort of playoff demons himself, I think missing a penalty for Leicester in the playoffs sort of, you know, 7 or 8 years earlier, for him to put that away, you know, with such confidence, and then for Reading to hold on, as you say, Al Habsi made a couple of fantastic saves, and just one of the great Mad Stad nights. I mean, as I say, this period's not been full of them, but that Bradford game in the FA Cup and this game against Fulham was one of the, you know, best memories of the decade. And obviously we move on, you know, finally now to that playoff final, which was one of the worst Man Sad memories of the decade. You know, we've spoken about you know, the playoffs in 2010-11, where, you know, that Cardiff away game was such a high to then go to such a low against Swansea. And it was, again, very much the same here. Reading going in against Huddersfield, and I think obviously both teams were unfancied in their semi-finals. Huddersfield weren't expected to beat Sheffield Wednesday, but they overcame them on penalties, and it was almost like the battle of the underdogs in the final. And it was really one of the most boring games you'll probably ever watch. I think there were just three shots on target combined for both teams across the 90 minutes plus half an hour of extra time. And it was a really, really bizarre game for me, Sim, because, as I say, there weren't really that many clear-cut chances. I think, the ball fell to Thiago Alori. That's one that sticks out to me, that the ball fell to Alori in the box and he put it wide, and it was just a wrong man to fall to. I think Izzy Brown probably should have put Huddersfield ahead in the first half, and the ball was played across goal to him, and he had an open goal to sort of just slide the ball into, but somehow put it wide. And other than that, there weren't really that many clear-cut chances, and that almost made the game an awful lot more tense. And then obviously you get the penalties, which is probably one of the worst ways you can lose a game of that magnitude. And again, it's the hope that kills you, because Reading were in front in the shootout. Ali Al-Habsi saved Huddersfield penalty. I think Reading were 2-1 or 3-2 up in the shootout, because Kermigan, Danny Williams and Liam Kelly had all scored their penalties, and Reading were just two spot kicks away really from going into the Premier League. And then it just goes downhill, and obviously Liam Moore and Jordan Obita both miss. And as I say, it's just the hope that kills you, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember watching on from the stands at the time, just thinking, we are not going to do this. I was there with my Pompey supporting mate, who's obviously had very different Wembley memories to us. And I remember telling him at the time, we are not going to win this penalty shootout, because... When you're a Reading fan, you just know that things are going to go wrong at Wembley. You know that things aren't going to end up well. And even when you're winning in a shootout, you always have that feeling in the back of your head, things aren't going to turn out well. We're going to screw this up somehow. And it's just so heartbreaking for people like Obita and Moore. We spoke about Federici earlier, about his fumbled shot for Sanchez, and when it falls on one player or two players in this case, it's really heartbreaking for them, and for players who had worked so hard across the course of the season and scored some important goals, particularly Obita with that goal at Craven Cottage. For it all to come down to that was just really sad for them, but it did cap off a particularly awful game, one of those really weird occasions when I think we actually would have been a lot better served going up against Fulham in the final, where we were the clear underdogs and we knew we were going up against it, or even Sheffield Wednesday. But when you're going up against another team that's the underdogs, perhaps they were the underdogs to us because we finished higher in the table.
Yeah.
When you go up in a game like that, it feels like we didn't really know how to get the occasion right. I don't think Huddersfield did either, because it was such a poor game from both sides. But in games like that, it just comes down to who has the most character. And obviously, in the end, Huddersfield held their nerve better than us.
Carried on our dreadful record in playoff finals. Obviously, I mean, the only two that I've seen were the Swansea game that we discussed with Johnny last episode, and this one, but of course, you know, going back before that, you know, the one against Bolton and the one against Walsall as well. So, yeah, there's part of me, you know, when you talk about playoffs, that there's a part of me that wants to, you know, qualify for the playoffs again, something in the future, and just experience that feeling of winning. Because, as I say, you know, four playoff final defeats now, we've lost all four of them, and it's just agonizing. But part of me wants to, because, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people say that the best way to win promotion is to win the playoffs. And, you know, I can certainly see that. But obviously, from a Reading point of view, with our record being what it is, I just want to experience, you know, just once in my lifetime what it feels like to win a playoff final. You know, but part of me just wants to say, you know, never playoffs ever again. I'll happily take winning the title. But that is where we are going to bring to an end this second episode of the Decade in Review, 2013 to 2017. Of course, it did then go all downhill for Yapstam and Reading following that playoff final defeat. But that's what will be discussed in the next episode, 2017, all the way up to the present day. And then the final episode will be a look ahead to the next decade in 2020, making a few predictions and just sort of looking at where Reading are now going into the new decade compared to where they were at the start. But thank you very much, Sim, for joining me on this second episode.
Thanks for a very therapeutic morning going over all those horrific memories from the last couple of years. Good to kind of finally put them to bed, basically, and hopefully move on to a much better decade next year onwards.
Indeed. I mean, even though it has been not the most, well, it's been fairly depressing looking back at these memories, but it's certainly very, very therapeutic, and it's quite nice in a sense. You know, it's obviously quite nostalgic, and going through these times, I think me and Johnny said the same, that you know, it's quite nice to look back at sort of when you're going through it. It's not quite as easy to look back on, you know, now it's been some time, as you say, that playoff final was 2.5 years ago, and you look at how much Reading's changed in that 2.5 years. So it's quite nice to look back on it, even though the end result wasn't the best. But thank you very much to you at home for listening to the second episode. As I say, keep an eye on your podcast feeds over the next 2 days when the second two episodes will be released. You can still get involved on our Memories of the Decade series over on the title. So not long left to go. Now, of course, not very many days left of 2019 and the decade. But if you do want to get involved writing your memory of the decade, get in touch. TylerSend@gmail.com is the email, or you can send us a DM on Twitter to let us know your thoughts. Other than that, as I say, keep an eye out on your podcast feeds over the next few days. But thank you very much for listening to today's show, and come on, you Arts.
Keep up to date with all things Reading FC. Follow the Tylehurst End on Facebook and Twitter.